Well, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, my dear friends, fans, colleagues, no matter where you are and when you're listening. Welcome back to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. I appreciate your listener loyalty. And some would say it is definitely time to awaken. You were hearing that opening music from Alea Deo. And today we're going to be talking about awakening from the standpoint of wisdom. The topic today is seven levels of wisdom, and our guest is Monica Esqueva. And I want to tell you a little bit about her because we're going to be jumping right in here. She is a renowned self-development teacher and spiritual guide who bridges the gap between Eastern and Western philosophies. We're going to discuss her journey of self-discovery, including the years she actually spent in India and Nepal, which enabled her to help the transformation of individuals, you know, her clients, you know, for more than 15 years. So we're going to cover topics I think that are interesting today about misconceptions about finding joy and happiness, maybe how we can change careers to be more in alignment with our life purpose, practical advice for personal transformation, and another, you know, kind of gut-wrenching maybe topic about how she worked with kids with cancer and hospice, but, you know, what those little folks taught her about death and the soul's journey. So, Monica, welcome to Voices of the Sacred Feminine.
Thank you so much, Karen. It's a pleasure for me to be here today.
Well, thank you, because you are calling us from across the pond. Aren't you in Madrid, I believe?
I am.
Yeah, yeah. So thank you. Thank you for that with our time difference and everything. I appreciate, you know, you putting yourself out to accommodate the show here at 11. So let's just jump in. You know, you obviously must have really been called to, you know, not just pick up a book and, you know, go down to the local temple, but, you know, you actually, you know, spent months in Nepal and, you know, and in India. What was happening in your life that you took what I think some would probably say a drastic step like that? You know, what was your motivation?
Well, I was born with spiritual, so it was I was like that all my life, and as long as I can remember, I had this closeness with divinity. And I asked my parents when I was a child, why we are here, why are we here, and what do we come from? What is the meaning of life? So those things were in me from the very beginning in this incarnation. It's true that I try to fit in, like most people do, and I study economics, and I got a bachelor's degree and a master's degree afterwards. I worked for Prada in London. I got a job as an executive in Paris. I had a well of life with a full social agenda. I married early, and yet I felt so unfulfilled. So what I did is I went to northern India, to Dharamsala, at the feet of the Himalayas, to do some research on the Tibetans living in exile. And I was meant to be there for 3 weeks doing that. And I missed my flight home, so I ended up staying 3 months. And instead of that, what I did is started studying with them, Buddhism, and receiving teachings from the Dalai Lama. And I realized that their message, their teachings were exactly what I had in my heart all my life. So there was a big resonance with Buddhism and the way they taught that. And what I did is after those 3 months, I went back home and I realized I couldn't go on with my former life. So I divorced, I left my job, I left my house, I left everything I owned, my plans, and what I did is I went back to my country to live with my parents again, and with whatever I could fit in my car. And I didn't know how I was going to earn a living, but I knew how I didn't want to waste my life. The only thing I knew is I wanted to contribute to a better world. And that's how it started. What I did is I got some training, mainly in the U.S. And then I would go for 10 years. I would go and spend 2 or 3 months every year with the Tibetan lamas, studying with them and doing meditation retreats. And this is a short story of what brought me here with you today.
So let me just ask you a few questions to kind of fill in the gaps. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of gaps, but the things that popped up for me, I wonder at, you know, as a young person seeking the way you were, you know, I have this picture of you not being the, you know, the normal child, you know, maybe playing with Barbie dolls or, you know, going out and playing softball with the girls' team or something like that. It seems like you were probably living a different sort of life. You know, and if you grew up in Madrid, I mean, that's a pretty heavily Catholic, I think, country. Did you grow up a Catholic, and do you think this was past life memories that were inspiring this at such a young age?
Well, this is a Catholic country, but it's less now than it used to be. It's true, when I was a child, I went into the Catholic Church to be able to find answers. But after a while, what I saw was not very coherent to Jesus' message. So I left that. It was when I was 14, 15, I had no interest in going to bars or getting drunk or trying drugs, for sure. What I did is I wanted to find answers and direction for my spiritual path. So I tried to read everything that I could find on spirituality, on transcendence, on understanding the nature of life and the mind. That is true. I remember one anecdote. I was at a class that was probably, I don't know, 17, something like that. And the teacher asked all of us, what do you want to do when you grow up? And people will answer, okay, I want to find the right person to settle down with. I want to start a family. I want to have a big house. I want to be a famous architect. And when it was my turn, I said, I want to become a person with a big heart and a very wise person. And then, of course, everybody mm-hmm. looked at me as if I was an alien or something. So, yeah, as you said, I always felt a little bit different, but I was not willing to compromise my identity and my goals in life, even if they were very different to most people. And I decided that I wanted to stay true to my mission, even if that meant being alone in life. And I was willing to pay the price.
Wow. You know, that's pretty impressive. And, you know, I can imagine your parents are probably real happy that, you know, you weren't a problem child. But then I bet when you, you know, took this, you know, this turn and gave up everything, got a divorce and, you know, moved away and packed up your belongings in the car, were they kind of thinking that you'd lost your mind, or were they not that surprised?
Well, they were not happy, that's for sure. But I told them, either I do this or I'm just going to enter a depression. I'm not happy with my life. I'm really, really unhappy. So it's either this or I'm just going to go into therapy and you are going to have a depressed child forever. And then they say, okay, we want you happy. So, okay, we will support you. They have been a blessing for me. They were always my biggest supporters in life. I didn't have many people helping me at all, but they were always there for me. So they were a blessing, really.
All right. So paint the picture for me a little bit. I sort of got lost. So you loaded up the car and you left Madrid for where?
No, I left Paris. I was living in Paris at the time, so I went back to Madrid.
Got it. Okay. All right. So from Madrid, you were making these retreats to Tibet and India.
Yes, India and Nepal. Yes, I went to Tibet, but Tibet is not a free country anymore. So they are not free to teach as they used to be in the past. So teachings, you have to go to India or Nepal or many other places where you can find monasteries and so on. But for me, for those 10 years when I used to go back every year to Dharamsala, I felt that Dharamsala, during that period of time, was my spiritual home. So there was something there that pulled me every single year to go back.
Yeah.
For those 10 years.
Well, and, you know, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but, do you think this was past life stuff, you know, that you were remembering, you know?
Yes, for sure. I do remember a life as a Tibetan Lama myself, like centuries ago. So, yeah, I had memories, and when I went to Tibet, I knew exactly where I lived, you know, many, many things, for sure. Yeah, that was a big resonance. But I, while some people have that resonance and they decide to continue that in this lifetime, that was not my case. I was very sure that I was born in the West for a reason. And I just had to learn many things or remember, we could say, many things to be able to do my mission here. But I knew that my mission was not in Buddhism as a Buddhist nun or a Buddhist follower or whatever, you know. I never even took the vows. So.
Right, right. Well, and Buddhism is pretty patriarchal too. You know, was that a problem?
No, because as I said, I was just there to learn the philosophy and to learn the map of the mind and the mind map of the heart, of this, how to change and transform your emotional structure, and how to dissolve the ego, and where were the steps that they will advise me to take to be able to reach enlightenment. So I went for those kind of teachings, but I was not interested in the culture itself or to belong to any sort of current or anything.
I get it. So you were there to get the tools, but, you know, it wasn't like you were, you were a fan of some guru or something.
Correct. I'm not that type of person. I have nothing against that. I think it's, I respect every choice, but that was not my choice.
Got it. So what were you doing for your day job while you were, you know, that enabled you to pursue this passion?
Well, I was already working as a transformational coach. So that's what I was doing for a while. And I will also teach executives at some MBAs and also in some companies. I was teaching them emotional mastery, mindfulness, neuroscience, and how to know themselves better because they were really disconnected with themselves. So I did that for a while. And the good thing is I usually went July, August, September, or December, January. I tried to find months where I didn't have much work and I could leave.
Right, right. And so do you think, and this might be off the subject a little bit, but do you think that helped humanize them as employers in the workforce?
I think so. I mean, at least that was my purpose and my intention. Then what they do with that, it's not up to me.
Right. Yeah, I guess I'm just wondering, you know, if there are many of those type executives here in the United States, I would tend to think maybe not. But anyway, I'm sorry, I digressed here. You mentioned, you know, you wanted the tools to help you become enlightened. How would you define enlightenment, Monica?
For me, enlightenment is a state of being where you no longer identify with your ego and you realize, not just intellectually, but you live from your heart, your soul, your consciousness. You live from the essence of who we really are at all times. So it's not easy. It's a very difficult thing to achieve. But at least for me, it's my main goal, my ultimate goal in life. So at least I have it as an ultimate goal. And maybe one day in this lifetime, in another lifetime, who knows? But if we don't try, we don't get there.
Right. So how would you describe your calling then?
My calling has always been to share, to learn first, to do all the changes that I can in my own mind, heart, emotional structure, and try to dissolve my own ego and try to help people alleviate their suffering first and foremost. And then those that are interested in continuing their path, guide them on the spiritual path as much as I can.
Yeah. Well, do you think a lot of us create our own suffering? I mean, obviously there's a lot of challenges out in the world, but do we tend to, you know, maybe make the wrong decisions or have the wrong perspective that just increases it?
Yeah, sure. I think so. And it's not easy for us because when we incarnate here, we inherit a software. The software is the ego. So this is not something that we can do without. It's something that we have, all of us. And it's very challenging because the ego wants the immediate pleasure all the time. And the ego runs wild. You know, we get jealous, we get angry, we do things for ourselves that are not good, you know, even if it feels good in the moment, but then long-term are really damaging to ourselves and others. So we follow the wrong advice, which is what the ego is always dictating. And it's very challenging to transmute and to transform that, very, very challenging.
But isn't the ego necessary, though? I mean, to stop us from being a doormat or to motivate us to maybe step up when it's necessary. I mean, it's not all bad, right?
I think the ego should have a role, and the role is the boss of security, you know, the chief of security for us. But the problem here is that we have promoted the ego to be the CEO of our company. So it's not in the right role.
Got it. I like that analogy. I like that analogy a lot. So what should be the CEO?
The CEO should be our essence, to be the consciousness that we are, the soul. I don't know. We can use whatever suits our own beliefs or our own motivation. We're talking about the same thing. It's the one running the show should always be our being, our essence, our consciousness, never the ego. The ego has a very particular role, and that is the chief of security. It's not prepared to be the CEO. And that's why we suffer so much and we are so lost and we are entrapped here in the matrix because we just don't see it.
Right. I was reading something last night. I've started delving, you know, and I'm a total novice at it, started delving into gene keys. Are you familiar with that at all?
No, I'm not.
Oh, okay. Well, there was a saying that, you know, in order to escape the prison, you first have to know you're in a prison. And I don't know, what you just said, you know, reminded me of that, I think, when you said escape the matrix.
This is the ego's prison, for sure. It's not something external. It's just the ego builds the prison and then forgets that he did that, and we have the keys in our pocket. We're still there.
Right.
And instead of saying, okay, this is a prison, it's a self-made prison, I have the keys in my pocket, there is a door, I know how to get out there. What we do in our society is, okay, let's paint the bars with gold and forget that we are in a prison.
So, with the United, because you're primarily I do have listeners in other countries around the world, but the majority are probably here in the United States, and I'll say we're mostly probably afflicted with Christianity, because you do have some background in it and have a way to compare. Where do you feel, where do you feel Christianity goes wrong? In the sense that it doesn't help us find those keys?
Well, I think all religions, when you take religions as dogma, they stop being useful. They start being a prison for yourself. So I think it's important not to follow the dogmas blindly. I think we should, in life in general, we should just question everything. And being able to see the resonance with our hearts and find our own inner guidance. But for that, you need to be able to let go of whatever your family or your surroundings have told you that you have to do. Even the authorities or the so-called experts, we need to become sovereign beings and be able to take decisions for our own minds, bodies, and life. And let we do that, we would just be like puppets of other people.
Well, that's true. And I hear what you're saying, and I totally agree 1,000%. But, I think about all of the people here in the United States that just want some priest up on the pulpit to tell them what to think and what to do, and they don't want to employ any critical thinking. It's really hard for some people to let go of the conditioning. What do you think are some, how does someone start to break free of those shackles of conditioning and start to use critical thinking for themselves?
Well, I think we are all subject to that since we are born in this culture, not just Christianity, but everything. We are told what to believe, what to do, how to dress, what our goals should be. We are told everything, and we believe it. So we all have heavy programming, and it's not easy to get rid of it. So in my case, and what I have seen when I work with people and I help people, it all starts with questioning. You have to be able to say to yourself, okay, this is what I have been told, but I need to discover it for myself. And I need to go and venture out and see what are the choices. And maybe, just maybe, this is not true. I need to find out for myself. So it's like Joseph Campbell's hero's journey, You need to be the hero of your own story. And
right,
it's not easy,
right.
because it's uncertain. You think that it's dangerous. You will have to face challenges on your own. And you have to leave behind the ships. And you have to leave behind whatever you have known, your community, and the approval of others. And it takes a lot of courage, but there's no other way around it. Sooner or later, we have to do it, with all of us. Each person on this earth has to go into their own hero's journey.
Well, true. I mean, it would be nice if people did. But, I think about my roots, coming from the southern part of the United States, growing up in that Bible Belt. People are living in their bubbles, and they don't even know they have options. They don't even know they ought to be thinking the way you're talking right now. It's just way beyond them. So it would take huge leaps to, you know, leave go of the familiarity for uncertainty. You know, it really takes a courageous person, you know, I believe, to break those shackles.
Totally. It's there's no other way around. But it doesn't mean that everybody's going to do it in this lifetime, you know. That's why we come back, because we have many chances. We have the chance to choose our own pace. We are all going home. We are all going back to source, go back to God, whatever we want to call it. But we have the free will of choosing how and when we are going to do it. So
yeah,
we can do it whenever we are ready. We cannot go beyond our actual level of consciousness. So
Right. Maybe
we're not ready for it. We still have to learn some other lessons, and we come back and we'll do it in a future lifetime. That's okay. It's not a problem.
Yeah. So when people, you know, want to try to change careers, you know, like you did, to be more in alignment with their purpose, you know, what advice do you have for them that maybe worked for you that you can share?
For me, something that was very helpful was to do some volunteering. Because instead of getting worried about the future and fearing that maybe you are not going to make it, what I did is I tried to focus on how I could give and show the universe that I was serious about my commitment to trying to contribute. So what I did is I went to volunteer in Tanzania. For 6 months, I worked in an orphanage and I taught at the school. And I don't know if I could be of any help, but I did learn many things from that experience. I learned not to take anything for granted as we do living in the first world, you know. And we have many things that people in developing countries will not have in their entire life. I think I grew much more appreciative and grateful because of that. And I learned to be humble and take the bus with locals. Being the only Westerners and the only white person always in the bus, squeezing like sardines instead of using a driver, because I wanted to adapt to their ways of doing things without feeling entitled. So I learned to feel interconnected with others, feeling a real brotherhood, a kinship with all human beings. And I think I also learned to be more connected with the joy of living, because I saw all those babies and toddlers that were born in one of the most challenging situations human beings can be, and they were always joyful. And I think I learned to be more grateful and joyful with life as it is, even if sometimes it doesn't bend your way.
Right. Well, and do you think we have difficulty finding joy? I mean, are our lives too complicated to recognize it when we have it right in our grasp, maybe?
Yes, absolutely. Because I think this is because we are never in the present. We are living in the past, regretting things, missing things that are not going to come back, or feeling guilty about things that we did and we cannot change, or we are planning or fearing the future. So no one is here to live life. So we have everything it takes and everything we need to be joyful, to be grateful, to enjoy life, to really make the best of this single moment, because it's unique. It's not going to come back. But we are not here because we are thinking about the future and the past. Then, of course, we are missing everything.
So would you equate finding joy with, you know, the thing nowadays is, and I do believe it, and I kind of think it's a magic bullet, but do you equate joy with gratitude? Do you think they're cousins or the same thing, or your thoughts?
I think it's close cousins, yes. I think we cannot feel joy if you're not grateful for what you have and what you are right now. Things could have wrong in so many ways, and they didn't. We are truly, truly blessed human beings, you know? And when we don't focus on that and we focus on when we don't have yet, or we want, but we desire and we have not accomplished, then we make our lives very difficult, and we stay in a complaint kind of attitude, which is not helpful. I think it's very damaging for ourselves and for people around us.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, why do you think we do that to ourselves? You know, are we living in fear, or are we living in just a lack of gratitude and selfishness?
Well, I think it's a bias that we have in our brain. It comes with the software because our brain was not designed for happiness, was designed for survival. So we have this thing that was developed 200,000 years ago when the environment was very hostile and there were a lot of predators around that could really finish our life. But we have the same thing. It's like we have a radar for possible threats and dangers, and we always go to the negative in a natural way because of that. But the thing is, today you don't leave the door of your house and there's a lion lurking and jumping towards you. And we still have that in us, in ourselves. So a proof of this is, what do you think about when you wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning and you cannot go back to sleep? Do you think about all the wonderful things that you have in your life, or all the things that you don't and you have to solve, and possible problems and worries? And this is how the brain works. So we have that bias, negative bias, and we just have to overcome it. But it takes a lot of work.
That's interesting. That resonates. It really does. And honestly, I hadn't really thought of it like that. I appreciate that perspective. I really do. So what would you say are some of the myths or misconceptions around finding joy or happiness?
Well, I think most people, or at least many people, think that they believe that their suffering is all about not achieving their goals or lacking things like money or followers or power or recognition or success, you know? I have worked with people from all walks of life, including millionaires, celebrities, and business leaders. And no matter what they have achieved or accumulated, and regardless of how the world sees them, they are in the same predicament. They all still struggle with this deep-seated sense of anxiety and dissatisfaction. Why? Because there is always more to attain and the fear of losing what they already have. I have a client whose father was a millionaire, and now his mother is a millionaire. And she lives in Switzerland. Well, now she wants to go and buy a house in Gastad. This is an upscale resort town in the Swiss Alps that is also called the billionaire's playground, because now she wants to be with billionaires. So there's no end to it. And this is a misconception that is inserted in our culture. We have been sold this idea that by having more of everything will somehow magically bring us inner peace and happiness. But I think serenity and contentment depend on how we interpret our experiences and how well we have cultivated our minds and hearts and fed our souls. So we need to make a big change there.
Yeah, I think so. You know, I had an old boss who actually taught me a wonderful lesson about wealth is not what it's cracked up to be necessarily. You know, he had enough money to do whatever he needed to do or wanted to do, but he spent his entire life trying to get more, trying to stop other people from stealing it from him. And he always thought somebody was trying to steal it from him. I mean, it was like his wealth owned him. I don't think he had much happiness from it at all.
Well, that's the thing. So that's why we have been sold this idea that everything we want is outside, is in the external world, is by getting more and more. And that's why people are on a frantic race that will take them nowhere, because there's no direction.
Right.
You know, and there's no end. You know, it's not a good way to live. And still, everybody's living that way. Not everybody, thank God, but most people still believe that myth.
Yeah, the idea of being content is kind of a foreign subject or foreign state of being for a lot of people, I think, you know, because they think they always have to achieve more, want more. I totally get that. Monica, I have to take a break, and sure. But we're going to come back, and I want to talk to you about you know, what you discovered when you were working in the hospice with the children with cancer. You know, maybe how we can promote better health, you know, in our communities. And, you know, if we have time, you know, I know you can't give us a lot of detail, but just maybe give us a thumbnail sketch of the seven levels of wisdom, you know, which is your book that you have out, which I apologize. I forgot to mention in your intro, so we're going to want to talk about that when we come back, too. How's that?
That's perfect.
Okay. All right. So we're going to jump over to Joe Carson and hear about Celebrate Wildness.
This is from Jonathan Nightshade, a Gardnerian high priest of the Whitecroft line, a traditional craft practitioner and researcher, writing about Joe Carson's book, Celebrate Wildness, Magic, Mirth, and Love on the Farafaria Path. I love this book, how special this work is and how appreciated. As someone who was young in the 1970s and through the years only found snippets of information on Farafaria, one of the first modern pagan paths, this book comes as an artistic revelation of the core practices of the way of the goddess and gods reborn for the next age of the divine maiden. She has clearly introduced the historical background, philosophy and ritual practices of the joyous wilderness mysteries of the fairy faith, illuminated by the marvelous pagan art of Farafaria's founder, Fred Adams. I was very pleased that the high-quality production of this oversized volume makes it a collectible work of art, as well as a testament to the visionary philosophy of Fred Adams. I feel blessed that I received a copy. I will treasure it and look forward to the next book for more of the deep philosophy and ritual practice of Farafaria.
Celebrate Wildness is a dense, art book quality hardcover book. You can get it for just $45 from the Farafaria website at farafaria.org. That's Farafaria.org.
So for those of you who know me, maybe you've been following my show over the decade, you know I am, you know, come down more on the side of an analytical Virgo. So it may surprise you to hear that I had an incredible experience with an authentic evidential medium. I probably wouldn't have even attempted something like that years ago, but I don't know. I guess my mind has mellowed. I want to tell you about this woman, Melody Rose Kranz. She is an authentic evidential medium, and she also does Akashic record readings where you can learn about your purpose or your past lives. She also offers one-on-one sessions as an awakening life coach. So I had a really good experience with Melody at her company Invoke and Raw. It was absolutely amazing, and I felt like she told me things she could not possibly have known, and that's what really got my attention personally. But another client said this about Melody. They said, Melody is amazing. Her classes are informative, genuine, a real eye and heart opener to true spirituality. One-on-one sessions, that they recommend one-on-one sessions with her. It would be a new experience for your journey. She makes you comfortable and you feel well taken care of. You know, I can actually attest to that as well. Another of her clients said, "What a great reading. Melody was able to connect with my mom and gave me specifics to put any doubt I had at ease. What a great feeling knowing my mom approves of my recent decisions and is watching over me. Can't wait to have another reading to see who else she connects with." So if you resonate with that at all, Melody does in-person or readings via Zoom. You can find Melody Rosecrans at her website, which is invokeandra.com. I know that's a little odd, so I'll spell it, invokeandra.com, or her phone number here, 541-291-1240, to schedule your session today. So if you just tuned in or you want a refresher, I am chatting with Monica Esgueva. I hope I didn't murder that. she's a prolific author you know, a self-development coach. She lives in Spain, and she has 9 books out there. Her newest is The 7 Levels of Wisdom. And we're talking about this spiritual journey of hers. And Monica, let's talk a little bit about how can we achieve better mental health in our society?
Well, that's a big, big thing nowadays, right?
Right.
I wouldn't say it's something to worry about, but I do think it's something that is really pervading our culture, right? It's else everywhere, and I think the good thing now is that we are talking about it. The latest numbers is that nearly 23 of American adults face mental illnesses issues only in the last 3 years. I think that's huge. And my question always is, how have we reached this point? I think first, the social model in which we live is a factory of anxiety, dissatisfaction, and unhappiness. And individuals seem like hamsters, constantly running and trapped on a wheel without direction or purpose, but we're going faster and faster, right? So I think one of the biggest problems is that we live in a society that advocates hedonic happiness, and it makes it the ultimate goal for most people to maximize pleasure in life. However, having balance and thriving, I think they go beyond the narrow definition of feeling good. And when you have this obsessive pursuit of hedonistic happiness, this can be very detrimental, because if well-being is reduced to merely feeling good, then drug users will be the happiest people on the planet, and clearly they are not.
Right.
So I think we have to understand that challenges are part of our life. Sometimes we plan and we have goals or projects that are not achieved, and that happens. And we have past wounds that still bleed, or you lose your job, or someone you love passes away, or you receive a serious health diagnosis, or your child is a victim of bullying and you just found out, or you have to go through a difficult divorce or a breakup. There's so many things that do happen in our lives, and it's very tempting to resist and to believe that we shouldn't have to go through the challenges. And that resistance, I think it creates a lot of frustration and anger and complaint, anxiety, and even addictive behaviors. So I think the important thing here is to realize that challenges are part of our life, and it's not so much what happened to you, but how do you interpret what happened to you? That's what Epictetus said. And Buddha said, happiness is not a set of circumstances. It's a set of attitudes. So I think that's the thing that we should be taught from early on. It's like, okay, we should work on our minds and our emotional structure to be able to face challenges head on and not thinking that we don't deserve it. It's going to happen
right,
sooner or later.
Are you open to taking a question from listeners?
Sure.
Okay. There they left. They had their hand up, so maybe they'll call back. Well, you know, I totally agree with you there, you know, because I know, you know, growing up, those weren't the sort of things that I was taught. Nobody I know was taught. And, you know, as you gain wisdom later in life and you survive these challenges, you know, if you can get your emotions under control, I think you start to realize that those challenges, you know, there were lots of silver linings and gifts in those challenges that helped you grow, you know, as a human. And I don't know, is that kind of where you're going with this, you know, to know that
Absolutely.
Life is going to have challenges and see, you know, and know that it's like the universe telling you, this is a life lesson, you know, this is for your resilience, so to speak.
Yeah, we have to understand that somehow at some level, even if we don't remember right now, our soul chose the challenges. We came for the challenges. This is the earth. I don't even see it as a school. I think it's a boot camp. You know, it's very difficult, but we came for it. We signed up for this. Even if right now from the ego standpoint, it cannot be true. Well, it is true. But I think we just have to take that as a part of the game. You know, that these are the rules. We accepted the rules, and now we have to play the game without believing that the game is real. This is just something that is going to happen for a while, and then we go back to who we really are. And that's part of the work we have to do.
Yeah, part of the soul's journey, as opposed to our life in this particular meat suit.
Yes, exactly. And the way I see it is, if we observe ourselves closely, we realize that the mind has a life of its own and gets entangled in the stories we fabricate that have nothing to do with reality, because there's no one single reality. There are 8 billion realities. And when you
Right.
understand that we are excellent scriptwriters, directors, and protagonists of the dramas in which we live, and that they are distorted movies that are filled with judgments, criticism, anxiety, envy, greed, negativity. But I think sometimes we could even win awards at festivals. But it works the same way that as when we go to the cinema and we immerse ourselves in the movie so completely that it sweeps us away and it provokes all kind of emotional reactions as if it were happening, that's how our mind works. So when you become aware of our automatic thoughts and attitudes, we can stop them. And we can choose another way of thinking, and then another way of feeling, and then another way of living. And I think that is totally possible. It's within our means.
Well, so I think what I hear you saying is it's really being, you know, being an observer, you know, of, you know, being able to take a step back from our emotions and how we choose to react to situations.
That's one part, for sure, to so be able to stop being reactive and be able to choose your actions. And the other one is working on all the negative thoughts and emotions that we feed, all that ill will that we have inside, and make it goodwill, and go from hostility and animosity towards others to cooperation and compassion. And
yeah.
It takes a lot of work. You know, this is not something that comes naturally. Of course, some people have it more developed than others, but we all have to work for that because there's a lot of cleaning up that we have to do.
Yeah, because it depends on the environment I think you grew up with, you know, and Yeah, I mean, we could talk about that for a week. So let's talk a little bit about your work with children with cancer in the hospice. What were some of the profound ideas or thoughts you gleaned from that experience?
I work at the local hospital with children with cancer, as you said, for 10 years. And it was very challenging and intense to witness the pain of these children and the suffering of their families. And I never witnessed children, that I was going to see children passing away. That was something I never considered. And I did. It was not easy. You know, I think intellectually I understood that everything happens for a reason, but I couldn't help but being deeply moved by what I witnessed each week that I went there. I would not be able to stop carrying the suffering with me. And I saw that my colleagues will not last volunteering there for more than a year because it's emotionally draining. You know, they became burned out. So I understood that to be able to continue supporting them and accompanying them, I had to see everything from a higher point of view. And I truly embody and integrate that everything has its purpose in the soul's journey, even if we cannot always grasp it from the ego's standpoint. And it's understanding that everything happens for us, not to us. And even in the face of something as challenging as cancer and early death. So for me, it was to understand this and to make a big change within me to be able to be there for them. And I had the fortune to have some profoundly beautiful and moving experiences with the souls of some of the children when they left their bodies. And I witnessed the peaceful transition and the perfect timing of their departure because nobody leaves a minute before or a minute after they should. And for me, it was a great lesson of acceptance and understanding that everything makes sense from a soul level.
So explain what you mean by that, something about what you said about the minute before or the minute after. I'm not sure I understood that.
Well, what I mean is that when we think children should not die, they are too young to die. Well, no. You know, the soul has no age. It's only the body that has some, that ages. So when you see a child dying and you think they shouldn't be dying, from the soul standpoint, that makes no sense to say that. Because souls come here just for a short experience. And because they are also facilitating an experience to their parents, for example. And everybody chose that. You know, those souls involved, they all chose that. So it doesn't really matter if your body is 2 years old or 100 years old. You know, it doesn't make any difference.
Well, and don't you think part of the problem is that, you know, our culture doesn't have a healthy relationship with death either?
Of course. Of course. I volunteered for a year in a hospice. And I thought I was going to be able to help them prepare the transition. And it was so funny because no one, not a single person there wanted to talk about death because when they saw the death approaching, they wanted to avoid the topic altogether. So, yeah, absolutely. Death is the greatest taboo in our Western culture.
Yeah. I know from looking at your materials that a few years ago you had a profound awakening experience. Can you elaborate on that?
I guess I can. It's not easy to explain, you know, when you go through these experiences. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners will relate to that. Since my first trip to India in 2006, I had several peak experiences or mystical experiences. And those events helped me see that there was much more beyond our five senses and beyond our intellectual mind. And I think it's pretty similar to the experiences people have when they try sacred plants, such as ayahuasca, with shamans in South
mm-hmm.
America.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that it was not my experiences were not caused by external substances. They just came out of the blue. And I think it's something that you cannot make happen. You know, it's not something that you can push. But for me, they were all very moving, very profound, and it's hard to put them into words because I think it devalues them when you try to explain them. It's like, how can you describe the taste of melon to someone who has never tried? It's useless, right? But those that have gone through it, I'm sure they know what I'm talking about. And sometimes I was able to recall past lives spontaneously in order to heal them, and sometimes I will just feel an all-encompassing compassion for all humans, even for perpetrators or killers. And it will move me to tears because I will feel my heart wide open. So it has been quite an experience for me, and it has really helped me to understand beyond what we see and what we can understand with our rational mind. But I guess what happened to me a few years ago is that I had one of those powerful, intense experiences, but this one had a lasting effect. It did not fade away. And what I did, and of course, as I said, it's ineffable. It's difficult to put into words. But for me, it left me with an inner peace that permeates my life. And I think that's the most important thing. It led me to leave my public work for a while. I was giving talks at the time. I was being on national TV. And I had to leave that for a few years to focus completely on my inner work until very recently when from my higher forces, my intuition, my higher self, it was decided and I agreed that I had to go back to share, you know, that now I was ready and many people are ready for it too. So here we go.
So are you able to describe it or do you think that would detract from it?
I think it's impossible to describe. All I can say is it was an experience of oneness. It was an experience of understanding from my heart the perfection of the infinite plan, that even things that do not make sense, even catastrophes or things going on in the world, they all made sense. Even everything that I have gone through, the difficult parts of my life, of past lives, in past lives I remember a lot of suffering I went through, it all made sense. It's like, okay, I cannot understand it from my rational mind, but from this higher point of view, everything is perfect the way it is. So,
it's like a veil was lifted.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, I totally get that. No, I know what you're talking about. So, is it possible to give us a brief thumbnail of the seven levels of wisdom?
I'll try. Well, I guess in the seven levels of wisdom, what I do is I offer a framework to understand how people go through different stages of development as they evolve in their level of consciousness. And these stages have differentiating characteristics. It's like later stages integrate the development of earlier stages, like Russian dolls. And you encompass the previous ones. And gradually, mm-hmm. they lead you to a higher and more profound and expansive awareness and understanding. So as you progress in your inner development, you undergo fundamental changes in your worldview, in your actions, in your self-perspective, in your choices, even in your moral reasoning. So we see ourselves and understand our lives very differently, depending on our level of consciousness. And as a consequence, this impacts our relationships and our way of living. And we can see this very clearly when we reflect on how we perceive ourselves and our world at 30 versus 50 years old, for example. So what happens is our worldview develops over time to become more inclusive and more expansive. And as we do, we are able to hold a greater degree of complexity and ambiguity. And also we develop greater compassion. So it's a path towards greater compassion and wisdom and inner peace, I would say.
So are you one of these people who, there's a lot of talk out there about, ascending from the third to the fifth or higher dimensions and frequencies and all of that. Is there a place for that in your worldview, or do you think that's what you've been talking about and just using different words to describe it?
I do see it that way. I do think we are in a shift of consciousness and a shift of vibration in our world, in our planet. But my book does not refer to that, because I think my work and my mission is mostly on helping people developing themselves throughout these stages so they can increase their wisdom, their consciousness, as I said, their compassion and their inner peace and their harmony. Because I think for me what is important from my viewpoint is working on yourself. And it's not a question of beliefs. And you are free to have any beliefs you want, but if you are not increasing the level of consciousness, you will not be ready for anything that beyond your mundane life. And
yeah.
I think that's where we have to focus our energies.
Yeah. So you're co-directing and hosting a documentary on the journey towards self-transcendence. Is that close to actually being aired, and will it be in English? Will we be able to see it here in the U.S.?
I don't think so, unfortunately. We are finishing it, and we are going to present it in Madrid in June. But for now, we are just doing it in Spanish. So I'm sure there will be other projects in the future, and I will be happy to do it in English as well.
Okay. Well, Monica, I have really enjoyed this conversation, and I want to give you the last word. I know we've talked about a lot, but is there anything that's really important for listeners to hear that maybe I haven't thought to ask you?
I think we have covered almost everything that is relevant right now, right here, right now. Let's just leave them with all we have said, we have discussed. And I will just invite them to reflect, to take the time to connect with themselves and to follow the inner guidance. The inner guidance is always right. We just have to stop and calm down our minds and our inner chatter so we can hear the inner guidance.
Right. So, your book, the most recent, The Seven Levels of Wisdom, they can get it at all the usual booksellers?
Yes. Right now, it was released a week ago, so very recently, and now it's available everywhere, yes.
And what's your website should folks want to... look a little deeper at maybe your other books as well.
Yes, it's my name and surname, so I can say it, I can try to spell it. It's Monica Esguiva, so it's MonicaEsguiva.com.
Okay. Well, Monica, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening to your inner guidance that certainly caused a lot of changes in your life, and I so appreciate you being out there in service to the world, and appreciate your time today to share your wisdom with listeners and myself.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Karen. It has been a real pleasure.
Okay. All right. Best of luck with everything. And if that documentary ever turns out to be in English, let me know, okay? And we'll do another show and let people know what's out there.
Thank you. I will.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay. Okay, listeners, stay with me just a little bit longer. I'm going to be right back after this.
Hello. Let me say a few things about Joe Carson's film, Dancing with Gaia, an exploration of Earth-based spirituality shot at sacred sites around the world. Here is Drusilla Pettibone on DearMist.com. I was truly touched and even awed by the film. I really appreciate that there is so much substantive information to digest. For example, the info about henges and tracing the horizon line is all new to me and totally fascinating. The film was very beautiful, and I was amazed how it was able to capture so many of the descriptions visually and seamlessly connect vintage footage with modern. I especially loved when images were dynamically superimposed on each other, like the lace with the water and the dancing in the flowering meadow. A visual feast and with so many layers. I am also pleased to have been introduced to Monica Shu and her work. It's so important for pagans to become aware of our heritage. It seems easily lost among so many new books, and the film really brought me home in a new way. Dancing with Gaia is available at dancingwithgaia.com.
Well, the last thing I want to remind you about, dear listeners, is the Renewal Retreat coming up in Sunny Valley, Oregon, May 31st to June 3rd. And it is my great pleasure. I'm actually going to be a facilitator one night talking about herstory and women's agency and healing the feminine wounds. Here's what the organizers of the retreat say about it to describe their mission and what they're doing to put on this fantastic event for those who attend. They say, what we envision is a strong community of women of all ages, races, and walks of life coming together around the sacred fire to share our stories, receive support, heal, and grow into our next best evolution. We welcome you to this inclusive community and empower you to take time to invest in yourself. Come with us as we embark on a profound journey of releasing, revitalizing, and realizing our true potential. Immerse yourself in the supportive embrace of Mother Nature as we engage in the art of letting go of what no longer serves us to create space for the lives we have always dreamed of. Our program is dedicated to revitalizing your mind and body through nourishing practices that foster holistic well-being. We're committed to providing you with tangible wellness tools and guidance to help you not only envision but also realize your dreams, empowering you to manifest the life you truly desire. Join us at the Renewal Retreat and embrace this opportunity to create lasting change among a supportive sisterhood of women. Together, we will embark on this journey toward a more fulfilling and purposeful existence. And again, it's located in Sunny Valley at the Sunny Valley Resort in Oregon, May 31st to June 3rd. To find out more, pricing and all the details, reach out to the organizer, Kate Bostwick, at her email, which is katebostwick@gmail.com. So you spell her name, katebostwick@gmail.com. And that about does it for me. And I am going to close with the usual homage to Sekhmet, our lion-headed mother, who teaches us to stand up, have strength, courage, resilience, to say no, have healthy boundaries. And here she is.